This is 21st Century Reformation at 21stcr.org. I like what you're saying in the Colossians 2 thing. Mm-hmm. To me, that brings a lot of clarity. Mm-hmm. You're talking about these matters being shadows, if you will, yes. types, if you mm-hmm. will, of a reality that was to come,
yes, and has
that been. Now has
yes.
come.
Yes, indeed.
And I think I look at it and I think, why would I want to live in the shadows? Mm-hmm. Why would I want to live in the shadows of the types mm-hmm. when now we can live in the real, the reality, the real thing?
Yes.
And so I know that whatever we do in religious form, whether it's a Catholic in the various Catholic high church issues and so mm-hmm. on, the programs and the liturgies, mm-hmm. we find them beautiful and lovely. And I'm sure if you're keeping certain holy days, you find, oh, it's wonderful mm-hmm. and it's beautiful. But is it really mm-hmm. what God mm-hmm. desires of his people today? Mm-hmm. If it is, then we better do it, and we better do every last bit of it.
Yes, exactly.
But if it's not, then we need to let go of that.
That's
and
right.
we need to get a hold of the realities.
That's right.
The realities, as you say, of an international program
right.
that exists today.
That's yeah. right.
I like that.
There's a lot at stake here because Christianity is an international faith. It's not just local to Israel. Isn't that the whole point?
Mm.
And one of the things that had to go really was the calendar. The calendar was fine in the letter for that time, but we must recognize a new covenant. And so in Galatians 4, something that many of us, I think, opened our eyes to a reality we hadn't thought about at all, but there are two covenants. One is Mount Sinai.
Ah, yes.
And guess what that is? It's the Ten Commandments. You know, the public has had the Ten Commandments celebrated unnecessarily in a way with the Moses film, you know, the famous film.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
But the Ten Commandments, I mean, can you imagine how strong Paul is here? Do people face this? He's talking about a bondwoman. This is in Galatians 4. Let me start earlier in verse 21. Tell me, again, he's impassioned here.
Yes, yes.
Tell me, you who want to be under the law, which doesn't mean under the penalty of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Some Sabbatarian groups had the gall to tell us that they knew better how to translate the Greek here. And this was supposed to mean you want to be under, well, nobody wants to be under the penalty of the law, I don't think. And certainly Paul, when he went to Jews, he said he would be under the law, you know, just temporarily as a concession. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't mean under the penalty of the law.
Right.
No, the Greek simply says, if you want to be under that system of law, right. the Mosaic thing, please listen to the law. I love that.
That's,
you want to be under the law, then listen to the broader Old Testament teaching. Isn't that clever what Paul is doing here?
Excellent.
You want to
yeah.
keep all those commandments, then I'll tell you something else there that you better listen to. And here it is. It is written in Scripture that Abraham had two sons. And verse 23 says, the son by the bondwoman, that was Hagar, I believe, wasn't it? The bondwoman.
Yes.
That son was Ishmael, that born according to the flesh, born under normal circumstances, as distinct from the other son, Isaac,
yes.
who was born according to a miraculous promise.
Of course, yes.
Wonderful.
Yes, right.
This is a marvelous lesson then. He says in 24, this is allegorically speaking, figuratively speaking, we might say, is an illustration. For these two women represent two covenants. My goodness, two covenants. So which is the first one? One proceeding from Mount Sinai. That, folks, is the Ten Commandments. He's about to tell us that the Ten Commandments are not God's ultimate word to the world. That's shocking. This one from Sinai bearing children who are slaves. If you want to put up the Ten Commandments in your house and say, that's my ultimate standard, be it realized then that you're under slavery, according to this text. It's not enough. The new covenant goes beyond that to a wider and broader law of love, doesn't it? But not in the letter. It's not the letter, it's the spirit now. So this is Hagar, he says in verse 25, and this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, the unconverted Jerusalem, not the church.
Yes, of course.
She is in slavery with her children. I mean, this is about as strong language as you could get. And then he goes on to speak about the real covenant, which is the Sarah-Isaac covenant. And you, brethren, in verse 28, like Isaac, are children of the promise, not the products of Sinai, not the products of the Ten Commandments, much less the products of Sabbath keeping.
Yes,
is it clear? You see? This is Paul at his most energetic, I think, in this book, because he's determined to get people together. And right now we're all divided on these very issues.
Wow, Yes, all of it. And I noticed, too, as you're reading, he's not saying that these two women, allegorically speaking, are one covenant in two phases or something. It's not.
Two covenants.
We have two very distinct covenants. One that corresponds to Mount Sinai,
that's right.
as you say, the coming of the Ten Commandments and all the rest.
That's right.
And then we have another covenant, which this woman is now... representative of this new covenant in Jesus Christ.
Yes, absolutely.
We have to decide which covenant we're under, don't we?
Absolutely.
It's not as though
right.
we can say, oh, we're under both.
Right.
We're not. You've got a choice.
We have a choice.
We can either be under this covenant that is not a promise, the one that corresponds to Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments and all of that, or we're going to be under this covenant of promise.
Yes.
That corresponds to Isaac.
It's very clear in Paul here. It's less clear for people when they read Matthew 5. You know, Jesus says, think not that I came to destroy the law.
Yes, of course.
Yes, I came to fulfill it, however. That word fulfill is very important. And it isn't clear what that means until he dies and ratifies the new covenant, until he then launches Paul into the program. So one doesn't stop at Matthew 5.
That's
you know,
right.
you must balance that with the words of Paul. And you know, Dan, it's interesting. Some people have been driven to reject Paul entirely. I know of believers in Messiah who has come who think that Paul is an atrocious false prophet.
Wow.
Because he's anti-law. And so they're now setting Jesus against Paul. Now, that's another religion, clearly. If Paul's a false prophet, we're all in bad trouble.
I agree with you completely. And if we can't get on the same page with Paul,
yes.
so to speak, I think we're in terrible trouble.
Yes.
And
Scripture is now lost, isn't it? Because
yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Paul is a large part of Scripture.
Without Paul, we're not. And then we have support for Paul coming from Luke. Who
yes.
traveled with him, obviously.
Indeed. Indeed.
And we have support for Paul from Peter and James and John on the one venture we talked about. They gave to me the right hand of fellowship.
Yes.
Peter is later going to support Paul as well.
Yes, our beloved brother Paul.
Yes,
our
indeed.
Our colleague Paul, with all the wisdom that God gave him. I think that's wonderful because we're not denying it for a moment. There was a struggle in this area in New Testament times,
yes.
but... We're 2,000 years on. Can we not get
surely
beyond
to goodness,
these
we can
struggles
have this, yeah, that's right.
and resolve this
that's
thing?
Right.
Or are we still all divided into 30,000 denominations?
Yeah.
What sort of thing does that present to the non-Christian world?
Well, there you go.
Who
that's
look
right.
at us and say, you've got one Bible, and here you are arguing about whether you can have a piano in the church,
yeah.
whether you can wear a necklace in church,
yeah.
whether you can have pork or not. These are very childish things. And the world would look at us and say, this is stupid. Ordinary, civilized, normal people know that these are not issues. I think Jesus, you see, was a normal person. That's why the ordinary people liked him. The ecclesiastical authorities didn't like him as much.
Right.
And I fear that were he to come back to our present denominational scene, he might say, my dear chaps, you know, if you were British, you'd probably say, my dear chaps. He's not. Well, whatever the equivalent would be in his own language. You're making the simplicity of the law of love, the unity of all in one faith, you've turned it into a nightmare of denominational confusion.
Yeah,
and I think we need to be very scared of judgment along those lines. We better get this right now.
Well, that's right.
In view of his warning.
That's exactly right. Well, and you know, and speaking of Jesus, I think sometimes it's easy to be a bit confused because we have Jesus who was indeed a Jewish fellow. And
of course.
We recognize that, very important. And we've talked about how important that is in relationship to his understanding of God.
Yes.
The one God and the Shema. But I think that Jesus shouldn't be confused. He was indeed a Jew. He was indeed born under the law.
Of course, yes.
Galatians, the 4th chapter and verse 4, is going to say that he was born under the law.
Yes.
He was and born of a woman, born under the law. But then in verse 5 of Galatians 4, Paul's going to say, to redeem them
yes.
that were under the law. What does that show? The people under the law needed redeeming.
Yes.
They were in trouble.
Yes.
They're in trouble along with everyone else, in spite of the fact they had the law.
Yes.
So... But this, you mentioned Matthew 5:17,
yes,
and
yes.
Jesus saying that You know, he didn't come to destroy the law, and I don't think he did. Right. That was not his purpose.
That's right.
But he came, and as you said, to fulfill it. Yes. And I think that's a very important point that people miss. But I was thinking when you were saying that, in Luke, the 24th chapter, in verse 44, Jesus is speaking to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. And it says, and he said to them, "These are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you," while I was still with you, and as we were going about our concourse and so on, "that all things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses, and in the prophets, and in the Psalms concerning me." And in fact, that has been happening now. These issues have been put in place by Christ. So, again, I think when Jesus says, "I didn't come to destroy it," he wasn't in opposition to it. He didn't come to destroy it. He came to fulfill the law, and everything was in it. And then what I think we have to understand is the law that God gave to Moses, God is the giver, ultimately. Then God is the only one who could supersede it or come and bring in a new plan or new program. And he did. The new program is based now on his son, Jesus Christ. If only we could appreciate that. If only we could realize it. We would realize Moses is not our teacher. Jesus Christ is our teacher. And Moses is not our master. Jesus is our master.
And
he is the one.
Paul clarifies this in detail, does he not? 430 years later came a form of the law under which we are no longer. It was a schoolmaster, a pedagogos in Greek, a pedagogue, a custodial guide. While we were yet children, so to speak, we were infantile, we needed that. But now that the seed has come, now that Christ has come, we're not any longer under that Mosaic law.
That's it.
It's painfully clear. Now, well, lots of types that are, that can be gotten out of that law. He's just shown us that, you know, the two women and so on. Lots of good instruction from that law. He can appeal to the law that the teacher should be paid sometimes. You know, you don't make the ox work for nothing. And he gets principles out of that. But he's incensed at the idea that you start mixing circumcision and the whole law that goes with that. If you do that, you're simply shaking your fist at Christ, and particularly his death. What strikes me in Galatians is so interesting. The problem is they haven't accepted that the death of Christ has inaugurated a new constitution. Recently I thought of this, Dan. A new constitution means God is now operating the world on a different principle. He can do that. Now people say, well, God cannot change. Well, his character never changes. I understand that. But he has every right to change the constitution.
Of
and
course.
He did it when his son died. And so Paul says, don't you see Christ placarded on the cross in front of you? Don't you understand that that blood ratifies a brand new situation?
Surely.
Don't go back under the law of Moses with your Sabbath keeping, your holy days, and your new moons, and your insistence on some of the law, the prayer tassels, or not, or whatever it is you choose. Don't do that, because now you are counting Jesus as nothing.
That's right.
You're slapping the cross.
That's right. As inadequate.
Face.
It's not adequate.
It's inadequate.
We can have him, but we also have to have the law also. And that's, Paul is not a law also guy.
It's not right.
He is saying Christ is sufficient.
That's right.
He is totally, completely sufficient. And I and you know, you were saying, if someone would say, well, I don't think God could change, you could not make that change. Well, actually, God made a change when he introduced the law. You think about it. The law was not something that was given
from the start
to Abraham or to Isaac or to Jacob or to the
not
fathers.
The law of Moses,
before. The law of Moses was not given to them. Well, you know, Anthony, if a person may look at it and say, well, God can't change these things. I mean, well, for starters, we really can't tell God what he can do and what he can't do. But actually, God could change. He could make a move away from, no one else could, but he could. Because he's the one who originated the law. He's the one who can move on to a different program based on Jesus Christ. And I think what you're saying is when Christ died, everything changed. It changed because God determined that it would change. God, that was God's plan. But I think we have to realize God made a change when he introduced the law of Moses and brought in the Mosaic program. That was a change. In Galatians, the third chapter, verse 17, Paul says, "And this I say, that the covenant which was confirmed before of God in Christ, Now, he's referring here to the covenant between God and Abraham and related to the coming of the Christ, when he would come. So this is the Abrahamic covenant, the Abrahamic promise. Then he goes on to say, that, having stood there, the law, which was 430 years later after that, can't disannul it, that it should make the promise of no effect. In other words, Paul is locating precisely when the law came into, the law of Moses came into existence. God is the one who brought it in. So we couldn't stand there on the day at Mount Sinai or and say, well, God, you can't do this. You can't make this radical a change. But God did make that change. He did bring in the law of Moses. It was 430 years. Paul locates it precisely. 430 years after the promise God made to Abraham. And so if God chooses then that in time, with the coming of his son, he's going to make a change and say, now, that law thing that I brought in, the law of Moses, we're setting that back. Now it's going to be my son, Jesus Christ, and we're going to follow him. He's the one that I'm going to give to you as your guide, your leader, your teacher, your director, your master. And we have to decide now, well, are we going to disagree with God and say, oh, God, you couldn't put that aside? Well, he's the one that brought it in 430 years after Abraham. If he could bring it in, he can say, enough.
Yes.
That's done. Now we're on to this program. All of that was brought in for a time, as you say, and it was to stand as shadows and as foreshadowings of what God really had in mind from the beginning. The law was a temporary a matter brought in with Moses and the children of Israel. And, you know, we have the scripture in Hebrews that's going to tell us that this covenant that was made there when they came out of Egypt, this is made with you that have come out of Egypt this day and your descendants. It wasn't made with your fathers. This is not a covenant I made with them.
That's
this
right.
is a covenant.
You know, that's Deuteronomy 5. It's a very important text.
Ah, yes.
It says, these Ten Commandments were not given to your forefathers.
No, yes.
That's not some eternal law, including the Sabbath, you see, at all. And the other point that's interesting in Hebrews is that it says there that there will be, that there was a change. God made a change in the priesthood.
Yes.
Well, how come,
course.
If God can't change, how can he change the priesthood?
Right.
See, those things are not irreconcilable.
Well,
no, there's a huge change. When Jesus died, we're under a new constitution.
Right.
The tragic thing is that we're all divided denominationally. See, on
yes,
this point.
Yes.
We cannot really go on forever disunited if Christian faith is going to make any big impact on the world.
I like your point coming out of Hebrews 7 about there being made a change in the priesthood.
The Torah, in the priesthood.
Because Christ was not of Levi,
right.
not of Aaron. So we have a whole new thing. How can you do that? Well, God can do it. He can. And what he's saying is they're being made a change in the priesthood. Then verily it goes further. So Hebrews 7 and verse 12 says, for the priesthood being changed, this would show us something else dramatically, that there is made of necessity a change also of the law, period.
The Torah, period. Indeed.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We haven't just made a change to the law. We have radically moved away from it. There's a whole change now to a new, as you say,
new order of priesthood.
A new law.
Absolutely. Yeah, while we're on that word law, Ephesians 2:15, which is parallel, incidentally, to Colossians.
Yes.
There's a very important word, dogma, in those two places, only in Paul.
Mm.
Dogmas are something we want to be aware of. You don't want to come under those dogmas.
Mm.
The dogmas about eating and drinking and Sabbath, holy days, and new moons are to be shunned. And then the same dogmas are related and described in Ephesians chapter 2. You know, the parallels between Ephesians and Colossians are most instructive because they interact with each other. But in Ephesians 2, he's warning them that if you insist on the food laws and the calendar, these are dogmas of the law which will re-erect the barrier between the Jew and the Gentile. It's rather like, you know, in American history, there was a huge barrier between people of different color. It was a revolution when we got over some of that. It was a revolution when Paul tried to convince his Jewish friends particularly that there's now a new situation in place, and to re-erect the hostility.
Ah, yes.
And he defines that word hostility. What was the enmity?
Yes.
It was the law of commandments in ordinances, in dogmas. A hostile thing, which Christ at his death, inaugurating the new covenant, has broken down. How dare you re-erect that and create laws now which keep the Gentiles out, so to speak.
Why in the name of reason would we want to build that wall back up,
which Christ
has gone to so much trouble to break down?
Right.
You know, and this is interesting to me, too. I think as Gentiles, we greatly misunderstand our place in all of this. We think we're going to keep the law as though we could just set out and do that. And in reality, there is a big problem for us Gentiles. The Jews had a problem. They were under the law, and it's still they needed to be redeemed. Unfortunately, the law wasn't redeeming them. It wasn't working. So but for us Gentiles, I think it's even further. We have to realize we were not part of the law. We were not part of that program, so that you could have been. You could imagine. Oh, I wish I had been back there with Moses, and I would have just marched right into the tabernacle, and I would have done this, and I would have. No, you wouldn't have. They would have chased you off. And the problem you had as a Gentile was that the law was not a covenant with you. The law was not a covenant with us Gentiles. And in reality, I think there's a beautiful. I say beautiful, but it's awesome. There's an awesome example in that in the temple in Jesus' day. You had the amazing temple, Herod's temple, if you will, and you had this amazing outer court, which was called the court of the Gentiles, and then you went from that into an inner court and another court and so on. But what's important about it is this outer court of the Gentiles. We have to realize that's as far as us, we Gentiles, could have gone in relationship to this system, to this program, and to this worship. Yeah. They called it the court of the Gentiles for good reason. It's my understanding that they even had plaques up or sound messages up in more than one language, kind of reminiscent of Over the Cross, but more than one language saying anyone who is a Gentile, you go beyond this point, it's under penalty of death. So I think we have to realize this was not a Gentile-friendly religion. And when we as Gentiles today look at, oh, well, wouldn't that be wonderful? We're just going to do this and do that. And so the only way a Gentile was going to be a participant in these matters was to become a proselyte and become legally a Jewish person, including circumcision and all the rest. But isn't that what Paul is even cautioning about in Galatians 5 and saying, oh, but I'm telling you, you who would be circumcised and keep the law, you're in a terrible circumstance. When you do that, you're bound to keep the absolute, total, complete, entire law. And I think Paul is saying, don't go there.
Absolutely.
Don't do that.
With all the passion that he can muster, because he sees how divisive this is. And we see the results today of denominationalism here, based exactly, I think, on this misunderstanding that can arise. We didn't mention the text in John where Jesus says, there are things that I want to say to you, but you can't bear them yet, right?
They
come through Paul. So it's not over with the teaching of Jesus.
Right, surely.
The ideas are all in place. Even in Mark 7, you have an interesting reference to the food laws, where Mark has a comment, thus he said, cleansing all foods, which I think is a very subtle thing.
Yes.
I don't think they understood that at the time, but Mark, reflecting...
Is reflecting back.
Now we understand what Jesus actually meant there.
Surely.
This was too much for them to understand at the time. The revolution was in process, but without Paul we wouldn't understand all this.
Surely to goodness.
So this is perhaps the most important subject, I think, in current Christianity, that we get beyond these divisive issues. We've not mentioned other legalistic issues, like you can't have a piano in the church, issues of skirt length,
Pants
or not pants. All of these things make Christianity looks so very regrettable in the eyes of, may I say, the more normal atheists and agnostics who can see that the essence of life is not bound up with whether you have pork for supper. These are not the issues that define humanity.
Sure.
We all recognize
and
that.
And they certainly shouldn't be the issues that define Christianity.
They certainly should not be. The greater issues are the laws of love. So the law, we didn't mention the beautiful phrase, the Torah of Messiah, twice in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 9:21. Paul is within the Torah of Messiah. That in itself implies two Torahs, not the Torah of Moses.
Yes.
He's willing to do the Torah of Moses as a concession when he's with Jews. Of course, he'll do anything to win them.
Surely.
And not offend them.
And he could, because he was by nature a Jew.
Yes.
So he could do that.
But once people come and try to affect the church as a whole and bring them into line with Moses, then Paul gets extremely annoyed.
Well, we have a terrible problem here, because it seems to me that if we as Christianity are going to say, we as Christians are going to say, God wants you to keep Moses' law, and that turns out not to be the case, then it's more than just a, Oh, well, we made a little mistake. This is a great error.
It is.
We are seeking to place upon that other person then a great load, as it were, what is called in Acts 15 a yoke.
Yes.
You referred to that earlier, I think. Would we put that yoke upon people? Would we put a barrier on some? Because we have the Gentile nations out here at large, and we're going to come to them and say, "Oh, by the way, you want to serve Christ, you want to be a Christian, you have to keep Moses' law, or at least as much of it, whatever we tell you to keep of it, you know, and you got to do that." And aren't we then putting a stumbling block in the way of many people, and you can from coming to Christ, even? Aren't we? We can say, oh, well, if they love Christ, they won't mind. They'll keep the law. But I don't think that's the way Paul looked at it. I don't think that's the way that even Peter was looking at it and others in Acts 15. We don't want to put any other burden on these Gentiles who are coming to Christ. We don't want to put any yoke upon, a yoke which neither we nor our fathers were able to bear. Let's don't get into that. Let's don't do that. And I think if we're coming today and teaching people, whether it's Jews or Gentiles, oh, God wants you to keep Moses' law, I don't believe that's true anymore.
No.
I really don't believe it's true. So, and I think we have to go very carefully there and think our way through these things.
The international essence of Christianity is a brand new thing, you know, that the Jew and the Gentile are equal status, with or without circumcision.
Mm.
That's absolutely different from Genesis 17, as we said earlier. And I love the text in Philippians 3, where Paul said, Philippians 3, where he says, we, Christians, Jew and Gentile, we're the true circumcision. That's very radical.
Mm.
Circumcision is the word for Jew, you know, in the New Testament.
Of course.
We're the true Jews, Paul says.
Yeah.
Jew and Gentile together, we're the true circumcision. He then speaks of Israel after the flesh, very important, 1 Corinthians 10:18, I think it is. He says, have a look at natural Israel, ethnic Israel.
Yes.
The fact that he speaks of Israel after the flesh is very significant. Why in America do you talk about Paris, Texas, or Paris, Kentucky, or I may have the wrong state? Because Paris is ambiguous.
Yes, yes.
For me, it actually means Paris in France. But in America, you've got to say Paris, Kentucky. Why does he say Israel after the flesh?
Yes.
Because he very much knows that there's an Israel according to the Spirit, which is different, you see?
Yes.
And that Israel of the Spirit is what he calls the Israel of God in Galatians. The climax of the book of Galatians, where people stumble and fall flat on their noses and say, no, he suddenly turns around at the end and says, well, I'm blessing unconverted Jews.
Yeah.
No, no. Now, he does have a future for Israel. Let's add this very important tradition here. In Romans 9 through 11, all good commentary recognizes that he deals with people who are now not converted. They're Jewish people. They're not converted. They've not accepted Christ. And he foresees a collective conversion of at least a remnant through the Great Tribulation, probably. That's granted. But having said that, to deny that when he says Israel of God in Galatians, to deny that he means the church is really a very blunt, I think, and limping interpretation.
Yes,
his whole glory in Galatians is that the love law is the canon that sums this whole thing up.
Excellent.
Peace be on that Israel of God. He says, peace be on you Galatians, and guess what? The wider church of God, you see? You Galatians, peace be on you who walk by the canon of love, and the wider church of God. Not there physical, unconverted Israel. That doesn't make any sense at all.
And the and that's Galatians 6:16.
6:16.
Yes, yes, of course.
It bears on our topic because we're surely tending to erect barriers that Paul doesn't erect, you see? And I'm against that. We've got to get this one universal international church. One other good point in Acts that you mentioned earlier today in conversation, when they spoke in other languages, it may well be that now, for the first time, they're not speaking in the holy language of Hebrew. This is not just a Jewish thing anymore. Although the scriptures were, of course, given, 75% of them, true, in the Hebrew language. Now, how come we're hearing all these magnificent truths in our own Greek language, our own native tongues out here? This is amazing. People get, I think, very confused when they think that they were just hearing them in the language. No. The apostles are actually speaking, getting the flavor that Christianity is not a national prerogative, although it does have Hebrew roots. We grant that. There's much that's very Hebrew in the faith. But it isn't those things that force you to be a Jew in lifestyle in order to be a Christian.
That's wrong.
That's wrong.
That's wrong. Let me ask you this, and I think this is one of the areas where there is a lot of confusion on people's part, but that's in the issues of moral character and moral matters, because we know that Christians are expected, we know this by the New Testament, are expected to be of moral character. We will not succeed in being perfect in this life, we understand that, but our goal is to indeed be like Jesus, to be like him. That should be our objective, and so on. But a lot of people raise the question, well, you're telling me that we're not under the law, so therefore, then we could kill our neighbor, we could, you know, it wouldn't matter if we robbed and stole from our neighbor or took our neighbor's wife or whatever. But that's not at all what we're saying, is it? The law did tell those people from 430 years after Abraham, the law did tell them, don't kill your neighbor, don't do these terrible things, and all the other various observances that they would have. And yet, what we're saying, we don't have to look at the law in order to understand what our moral considerations need to be. We have a teacher. Would you agree with that? We have a teacher who's teaching us all things. Yes.
He did it very well in the Sermon on the Mount, because he immediately contrasts the letter of the law, Jesus does, right, with the spirit of the law. And Paul, of course, excludes from the kingdom those who persist in committing adultery and stealing and so on. So that's absolutely clear. The mistake is made when people look at the Ten Commandments as the ultimate law, because then immediately you're faced with the Sabbath. What they've not seen is that the Sabbath belongs with that trio of observances. How do I know that? Well, 11 times in the Old Testament we have that trio. The only occasion on which Paul mentions the word Sabbath in all of his letters is to put it in contact, in harmony with the other two observances, namely new moons and annual holy days. Paul spiritualizes the Passover beautifully. He says Christ is our Passover.
Yes.
It's not a matter of celebrating something once a year here. When you come together, you're doing the Lord's Supper, which was initiated on Passover night. That's true. But notice what he does with unleavened bread. He doesn't say, you'd better be getting the leaven out of your cars and your houses 1 week in the year. Right. No, he's talking about the unleavened bread of truth.
Sincerity.
And genuineness.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Oh, I see, Paul. And further than that, he says, let us be keeping the feast. That's not, let's observe the feast once a year. Let's be rejoicing day by day, because this feast, you know, is now a spiritual feast. Continuously.
Wonderful stuff.
What's more, we should be keeping the Sabbath, which means not just resting on the seventh day. That's not the point in the New Covenant. But we should be not doing our own works day by day. We should be ceasing from our own works in order to follow the continuous work.
All of the things of God. That's right.
These are very clear, then, moves from the letter to the Spirit, which is the sum total of what we're talking about here.
I love it. Well, then is it fair to say that when I, as a Christian, are stepping up, and as a Gentile Christian, I might add, I'm not going to say, well, I'm not going to kill my neighbor, or I'm not going to kill the friend down the street, because Moses said something back on coming off of Mount Sinai. No, I don't have to put myself under Moses and him as my teacher, or Moses as the law, and be under his law to realize what how I should conduct myself in relationship to the people around me and to our life, because we have the teacher.
Yeah.
We have Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And actually, what I need to know, he has taught us. Now, I cannot draw, as you say, the scriptures are profitable for teaching and instruction and good things and so on. Yes, all the scripture is profitable, but that doesn't mean that all of it is upon us as Christians today.
In the letter,
you know,
yes.
I think that we have Jesus Christ as our teacher, as our master, and we have the ultimate teacher. You know, if Moses were here, Moses would take a seat at Jesus' feet. I am confident.
Yes. Yes.
And in the kingdom, every knee is going to be bowing in the kingdom.
Yes.
Moses' knee will be bowing to
right.
Jesus Christ. That's how important Jesus is. And I'm afraid, because of the way that this has been misconstrued, people are not realizing the power and the greatness of Jesus Christ as Lord and as ruler. He is the one who is our guide, our director, and he is the one through whom God has now spoken in this day. God spoke to the fathers by the prophets, the writer of Hebrews says, but now in these days, here, he's spoken to us by a son, his son Jesus. Well, as a Gentile, I don't have to be under the law of Moses to know I shouldn't be killing in my neighbor or doing something grievous to my neighbor. I am under the law to Christ. And isn't that, again, what you were referencing
yes,
a minute ago?
Yes, twice there in the end of Galatians. The whole Torah is now summed up under the law of
yeah.
love. And that's a new thing in John, by the way. Jesus speaks of the new commandment.
Ah, yeah, not an old commandment.
It's not an old commandment. It's
this
new
is a
commandment,
new one. Yeah.
A brand new commandment
yes.
of love. So something has changed. The law was given by Moses, John says.
Mm-hmm.
Grace and truth are mm-hmm. fully explained then under mm-hmm. the new commandment. I just want to mention one thing in regard to the Sabbath. The argument has been promoted that Jesus was crucified on a Wednesday and raised on the Sabbath, you
right.
see, so the Sabbath is all important.
Right.
That's simply false on the evidence of Luke, and one can look at Luke's account and see that that could not be true. On the Sunday following the death of Christ on the previous Friday, on that Sunday of resurrection afternoon, actually, he'd been raised in the morning, that very afternoon they're walking, you know, some of the disciples
yes,
are walking to Emmaus,
course.
And they were hoping that Jesus would have restored Israel, which is great. That's the kingdom hope.
Right.
And then they say, and besides all that, today's the third day
yes.
since that crucifixion.
Wow.
The third day in Luke's reckoning is counted inclusively.
Mm.
Jesus in chapter 13 says, today, tomorrow, and the third day. I'm working today, tomorrow, and the third day. An inclusive reckoning.
Mm.
Inclusive reckoning back from Sunday is Friday. Sunday is not the third day since Wednesday.
Mm, mm.
There's another little point that's been missed in the end of chapter 23 of Luke. And Luke is very precise here.
Yes, yes.
He says that the Sabbath was approaching. Actually, he simply says Sabbath was approaching, or as we might say in English even today, not the Sabbath exactly, but Sabbath was approaching.
Mm.
And then a couple of verses later he's saying, and they rested on the Sabbath, that Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
There's an article there that points back to the Sabbath just mentioned.
Ah, yes.
You see, a great fuss was made in some quarters about two different Sabbaths here.
Ah,
that's
yes,
simply
that's
wrong. If Luke is communicating well at all, he could not have done that to us. First, Luke says that Sabbath was approaching, and they prepared the spices, and they rested on the Sabbath.
The Sabbath.
The one I've just
the
mentioned.
The one we just were referring to. That's right, yes. That's
Can
right.
you imagine the confusion that's caused? But I'm afraid people have gone to every possible length to distort common sense and Greek grammar.
Mm-hmm.
To promote a Sabbath keeping. It's divisive, it runs contrary to the whole gist of what Paul has to say to us, I think.
The on the moral question, too, I was thinking as you were talking, Paul says in Galatians, the 5th chapter, and verse 14, he says, for all the law, not part of it, but all the law
yes.
is fulfilled.
Yes.
In one word, even in this, or one statement, in one thought, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's interesting. And I think you're going to find that that's what Jesus is really bringing to the people as well. The fulfillment of the law is accomplished through love. And when Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments, he's not talking about the Ten Commandments off of Mount Sinai. If you love me, you keep my commandments, the ones I'm giving to you now. As you noted so well a minute ago, he says, a new commandment I give you. What is this new commandment you're giving us, Jesus? Not one that they'd had before. A new one, that you would love one another. And love one another as I've loved you. Wow. So the moral character of the law is being fulfilled. Paul says, not a little bit or not partially or something, but the moral character of the law that everyone's concerned about is fulfilled in this law of love. And Jesus says, this is a new thing. This is something new I'm bringing to you. If you love me, you keep the commandments I'm giving you.
Yes.
You keep this commandment to love one another. I think, does that make sense?
It does make sense to me. The danger, I think, of coming under the law wrongly, of adopting the identity markers of Judaism.
Yes, yes.
Is fundamentally false to Paul. But you can't have it both ways. You cannot have Paul and an insistence on the identity markers of Judaism. That's going to be wrong.
Okay.
We didn't mention entirely that in the Sermon on the Mount, he does say you've heard certain things, but I'm saying something more. You've heard about not committing adultery, but let's go beyond that. So there is a fulfilling of the law, a heightening of the law, a getting at the real meaning of the law. The real intention of the law was not that you just rest on one day a week. It was that you rest from your own works to do God's work. But there's another very interesting point I just want to mention, Dan, in Matthew 12, where Jesus says, you've heard that there are workers on the Sabbath who are innocent. Don't you know, he says, that the priests, when he's accused of breaking the Sabbath,
of course,
right?
Yes, right.
Haven't you read in the law now, just as Paul will appeal to the law, to do his Sinai thing,
right,
his Hagar, Sarah thing. Haven't you read in the law how there is a group of people who break the Sabbath, Jesus said, break it, and are innocent?
Yes.
Who, may I ask, are these people who are breaking the Sabbath and are not guilty?
Yes, yes.
Then he says, greater than the temple is here. He and his little group are the real temple. And the type of that, the typology is beautiful. The foreshadowing of that is the fact that you could be a priest and work on Saturday. And I want to tell people, you can be a priest in the New Covenant sense, or a priesthood of all believers, and you're not bound by Sabbath keeping. Now, I know it's rather revolutionary, but at some point we do have to challenge some of these markers of denominationalism if we're going to resolve this hideous problem of 30,000
denominations
disagreeing denominations.
That's right.
Something has to go.
Something's not right somewhere, obviously.
Something's gone wrong.
That's right.
Are we indulging here in an ecclesiastical muddle on a grand scale?
An unnecessary one.
Unnecessary.
An undesirable one, actually. I've heard folks to produce this thought. So, keeping the law is nice. It's just really pleasant and nice, and it's a good thing to do. I don't think you could ever get Paul to say that is the case. Paul's concern was that by you saying, well, I just keep it because I like it. I keep it because it's nice. I think what Paul's going to say to you, oh, my lands, no. Because you're going to encourage the idea. You're going to encourage the thought among your fellow believers and others and Gentile people and Jewish people that law keeping is what we should be doing.
Yes.
And I think Paul is going to tell you, don't do it.
Yes, you're misrepresenting the faith.
Yeah, you're giving us an entirely wrong picture. And the truth is, no, keeping the law for Gentile folks, for goodness sakes, it's not nice. It is not something we should be doing. I'll tell you what's nice. What is nice is for us to glorify God for Jesus Christ in this new covenant that God has given us. And it is nice to not be entangled. I like that word.
Yes.
Paul says in Galatians 5:1, don't be entangled with that system that went before. Don't be entangled again with that. So I think the risk we have is that, I think it would be nice to keep this law and that law and this part of the law and that. Actually, I think Paul would say, don't get entangled in all. The more you wrestle with it, the more you become involved. And I think that's not what Paul wants you to do here. It's not what
I think that's the message.